Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Welcome, everybody. It's my pleasure to see you here tonight to celebrate poetry and the poetry of Michael Ananiah and Hakeem Adabudi. I'm Kenneth Clark. I'm the director of the Poetry Center. And thank you. It's an organization that was established 30 years ago by a team of Chicago poets. Michael, you were one of those. The Poetry Center has presented through its reading series hundreds of the world's poets of the people of Chicago. And that's no lie. This is one of several events of the Poetry Center's 31st annual reading series, and we have an excellent season, and you can explore that season in our brochure. It's the one with Richard Hull's art piece on the cover. Tomorrow night, Mary Kinsey and Christian Wyman read. These two nights, along with the broadsides featuring the poets reading in these 2 days, are one way that we are celebrating the Poetry Center's 30 years. All four Chicago poets who are wonderful artists. In addition to the reading series, the Poetry Center operates hands-on stanzas where Chicago poets teach their poet protégés. This year, 33,000 inner-city students will learn how to read and write poetry through this program. I want to thank our volunteers, our members, new and old. If you're not a member, please join. We need you. I also want to thank the Poetry Center's board of directors, our volunteers. The tables at the front and the back are all manned by volunteers. So can you... Thank you. Thanks to our volunteers. And my staff, Shirley Stevenson and Zoe Lutala, we're a micro staff of three, so we work hard to make events like this happen. Poetry Center is in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. We've been here for 20 years, and they let us use this ballroom for poetry readings like this. Support for the Poetry Center's programming comes from Lannan Foundation, Target Stores, Poetry Center members, the Illinois Arts Council, the Lloyd A. Fry Foundation, Polk Brothers Foundation, the Chicago Community Trust, a new grant from the MacArthur Fund for Arts and Culture at the Richard Driehaus Foundation, Verizon Foundation, Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Alan and Lynn Turner, Bank One, the Fund for Poetry, Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, Fred and Susan Novi Family Foundation, and LaSalle Bank. I want to thank Can TV, these guys over here with the cameras. They will air this November 8th. Is that what it was? November 8th, this will air on Channel 21, so if you want to, you know, see this again, it'll go out to their million viewers. Okay, a little bit about the person who's going to introduce both of our poets. Simone Mensch's poems have been published, or are forthcoming in the Paris Review, Indiana Review, and others. The Air Lost in Breathing, her first book, was a recipient of the Marion Moore Prize, and she was recently awarded an Illinois Arts Council Fellowship. Simone's new chapbook, Notebook, Knife, and Mentholatum, has been released by New Michigan Press, and she is currently pursuing her PhD at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where she teaches composition, literature, and poetry. She is an associate editor for another Chicago magazine, and last year she was awarded first place in the Poetry Center's 9th annual juried reading, which was judged by Ann Waldman, and the year before that she won second place, which was judged by James Tate. So everybody, welcome Simone.
It is my pleasure not to introduce one, but two people that are nominated for the Poet Laureateship of Illinois, as most of you know. And Hakeem Adabudi, it is another pleasure just to be able to say his name. As a poet, there's nothing I love more than lyrical names, so I've been saying his name all day, Hakeem Adabudi. I, unlike Michael, don't know Hakeem personally, so I Googled him. And he came up with something like 1,700 sites. And I'm going to go through some of the things I discovered. He was born in Little Rock. And my favorite detail about this is Little Rock, Arkansas, established Hakeem Adabudi Day in 1999. And Little Rock, Arkansas, is a very understated place, having lived there myself. He received his MFA from the University of Iowa. He also attended the University of Illinois, and he is the author of over 20 books, of which I'm not going to list, or I would be up here longer than he would be. But I will list a few. One is his most recent, which is memoirs, Colored on Arrival, Don Lee to Hakimata Booty. And then his book of poetry, Heart Love, Wedding and Love Poems, and a selected book of poetry, Groundwork. Other details, he began the Third World Press, which I find this incredibly impressive, with $400. And it has the honor of being the longest operating African-American press in America. And that's a feat, to only have $400 to start that with. The other feat, which puts him, as far as I'm concerned, in the Rockstar Hall of Fame, is that his book, Black Men, Obsolete, Single, Dangerous, has sold almost 1 million copies. And all of you who are poets in the audience know that that is very rare. He directs the Institute of Positive Education. He also created the Black Books Bulletin that gave a forum for book reviews for African-American writers in the 70s, which lasted 8 years. Besides poetry and memoirs, which accounts for his numerous books, he writes critical essays, two of which are Dynamite Voices, Black Poets of the 60s, and Enemies, Clash of Races. His awards are numerous, and once again, I'm going to limit myself to a few. The American Book Award, the National Endowment for the Arts Award, the National Endowment for the Humanities Award, and the Gwendolyn Brooks Distinguished Poets Award, as well as being considered a distinguished professor at Chicago State University, where he currently teaches, and is director of the Gwendolyn Brooks Center. In reading Makubudi's poems, there is one phrase that has always struck me. Being a Southerner myself, I used to escape Sunday sermons and listen to my grandmother's, believe it or not, 8-track on disco. And in his poem, Is Truth Liberating, he writes, We wrap our lives in disco and Sunday sermons. And he has an ability to capture music from such a chasm of different areas. And in the final poem that I'm going to read from, it's a poem called Destiny, and it seems apropos. Resurrect work. Check your distance blue. Come, earthrise men, deep black and ready. Come, sun-baked women, root culture on the move. Just do what you're supposed to do. And on that note, I will let Mr. Hakimata Booty do what he's supposed to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here, and I really appreciate the invitation from the Poetry Center and its staff. It's always good to be with Michael Anania, who's one of the finest poets in this country. It's always good to be with him. I'm going to start with just a few comments. First, I'm the director emeritus of the Gwendolyn Brooks Center. Quaish Ali Lansana is the current director of the Gwendolyn Brooks Center. And sometime when you go to the web, there's some information that's not up to date. But other than that, thank you for your very fine introduction. That was quite nice. I want to just say that art is always under attack from many different forces. But art is fundamental instruction and food for people's soul as they translate the many languages and acts of becoming, often telling them in no uncertain terms that all humans are not pure or perfect. However, the children of all cultures inherit their creator's capacity to originate from the bone of their imaginations, the closest manifestations of purity, perfection, and beauty. Art at its best encourages us to walk on water, dance on top of trees, and skip from star to star without being able to swim, keep a beat, or fly. A child's on fire imagination is the one universal prerequisite for becoming an artist. So magnify your children's minds with art. Jumpstart their questions with art. introduce the children to the culture of the world through art, energize their young feet, spirits, and souls with art, infuse the values important to civil culture with art, keep them curious, political, and creative with art, speak and define the universal language of beauty with art, learn to appreciate peace with art, approach the cultures of others through their art, introduce the spiritual paths of other people through their art, keep young people in school off drugs and out of prison with art, keep their young minds running, jumping, and excited with art, examine the nurturing moments of love, peace, and connecting differences with art. Art allows and encourages the love of self and others. The best artists are not mass murderers, criminals, or child molesters. They are in the beauty and creation business. Art is elemental intelligence, working democracy, freedom, equality, and justice. Art, if used wisely and widely, early and often, is an answer and a question. It is the cultural lake that the indigenous rivers of dance, music, local images, and voices flow. Art is the waterfall of life, reflecting the untimely and unique soul of a people. Art is a drumbeat of good and great hearts forever seeking peace and a grand future for all enlightened peoples. For these are the people the world over who lovingly proclaim, give the artist some. Kind words, financial support, yeses from the heart, knowing intuitively that there will be creative reciprocity in all that they give us. Why? Because fundamentally, art inspires, informs, directs, generates hope, and challenges the receiver to respond. And finally, and this is consequential, the quality of the art determines the quality of the responses. Thank you. I'm a part of the sub-60s and, you know, the Black Arts Movement. I'm going to start a little bit beyond that, say, 70s, and come on through, maybe a poem or two from each decade. Big Mama. Finally retired, pensionless. From cleaning somebody else's house, she remained home to clean the one she didn't own. In her kitchen, where we often talked, the Chicago Tribune served as a tablecloth for the two cups of tomato soup that went along with my weekly visit and talking to. She was in a seriously funny mood, and from the get-go, she was down, real down. Roaches around here like letters on a newspaper. Are you going to be a writer, huh? When you going to write me some writing? Or the way Negroes act around here, if talk could kill, we all be dead. She's somewhat confused about all this blackness, but said that it's good when Negroes start putting themselves first and ahead it. We've always shopped at the color stores. And the way Negroes cut each other around here every weekend, that white man had to worry about no revolution, especially when he had to pay for it, too. Anyhow, all he got to do is drop a truckload of dope out there on 43rd Street and all your Negroes and your revolutionary be too busy getting high, and then they'll turn around and fight each other who got the mostest. We finished our soup, and I moved to excuse myself. As we walked to the front door, she made a last comment. Now, Luther, I know you done changed a lot. But if you can think back, we never eat too much pork around here anyways. It was bad for the belly. I shared a smile and agreed. Touching the snow lightly, I headed for 43rd Street. At the corner, I saw a brother crying while trying to hold up a lamppost. Through his watery eyes, I could see Big Mama's words. At 68, she moves freely, is often right, and when there's food, eats joyously with her own real teeth. This is thank you. This is from Book of Life, which came out in the 70s. Positive movement would be difficult but necessary. And this poem was written for John Oliver Killens. John Oliver Killens, for those of you who do not know his work, is one of the finest fiction writers that we have the honor of claiming in the African-American community. John Oliver Killens was the first of the real giants who started writers' conferences at Fisk University back in the 60s. And he invited Gwendolyn Brooks. Gwendolyn Brooks told him about Don L. Lee, and he invited me, Don L. Lee, at that time. And that kind of launched my national presence on the poetry scene. So this poem is written for John Oliver Killens. Remember past ugly to memories of the once, to memories of the used to be, lost days of glory, forgotten, forgiven history of the race, when sun mattered and the night was for sleeping and not for playing the death of enemies. Beautiful. Real pretty like morning vegetation, beautiful like African women bathing in Tanzanian sun, beautiful, a word now used exclusively to describe the ungettable, a word used to describe roaches disguised as people that viciously misuse the world.
Times is hard, Rufus, and they're going to get harder. Come on, champ, chop, chop. Hit hard, hit harder. Catch up, chop, chop. Sleep less. Eat right, rise earlier. Whip dust into the eyes of excuse maker. Talk to your children about meaning. Talk to your children about working for the race. Chop, chop, hit hard, hit harder. Beat it, beat it, beat it, beat it now. In this world, we face our comings as hip slaves, unknown to ourselves, unknown to the actual challenges of the race. Do you know your real name? Do you know the real reasons you are here? Check the smiles on your enemies' faces. If you can identify your enemies, they crawl from the earth in many faces. Negroes, militants, revolutionary integrationists, soul brother number 15, black capitalists, colored politicians, and pig eaters lying about their diets. Listen now. Open your ears. We got a number for you. Listen, somebody's trying to tell us something. Listen, somebody's trying to pull our minds. It ain't magic. We'd be better if it will. Listen, let the words speak greater levels of meaning. Split in their words. Beat, beat it, beat it, beat it, words. Beat it now. It ain't gypsy tales or trails or false eyes fronting for the devil. It ain't about the happy ending of the West unless you're reading the future wrong. You're right. I published a book in that same decade called Book of Life. And we were struggling very heavily here in Chicago. And Mayor Daley, number one, had launched the Red Squad and a few other unsavory things on us. And nationally, of course, you had COINTELPRO. You had a few other unsavory acts being happening to black people in struggle. And so we were in a deep funk trying to stay alive. And I wrote this book primarily just to, I had made a couple of trips to Africa. And so these poems I call life poems. They're very short, like parables. I'm only going to read a few of them, life poems. There are no titles, just numbers. Number one, the best way to effectively fight an alien culture is to live your own. Number 10, there's much to be learned. There's much to be unlearned. To do both takes an open mind and a mind that questions. We can get correct answers only if we ask the correct questions. Number 15, know yourself first, that which is good, that which is bad. Correctly assess yourself, and you will not mistakenly assess your neighbors. Number 20, knowledge of self starts at home. Understand that which is closest to you first. Understand that which is nearest brings meaning to that which is far. Number 60, to hate oneself and one's people is not normal. To perpetually wish to be like other people is not normal. To act against oneself and one's community is not normal. That which is normal for us will never be normal for us as long as we have to let the abnormal define what normality is. Between 1973 and 1984, I didn't publish poetry at all. I wrote a lot of poetry, but I didn't really publish it. You know? And then the next book to come was Earthquakes and Sunrise Missions. And that was in 1984. And I tried to kind of put my thoughts about poetry in perspective. So this is a poem titled Poetry. Poetry will not stop or delay wars, will not erase rape from the landscape, will not cease murder or eliminate poverty, hunger, or excruciating fear. Poems do not command armies, run school systems, or manage money. Poetry is not intimately involved in the education of psychologists, physicians, or smiling politicians. In this universe, the magic, the beauty, the willful art of explaining the world and you, the timeless, the unread, the unstoppable fixation with language and ideas, the visionary, the satisfiable equalizer screaming for the vitality of dreams, interrupting false calm, demanding fairness in a new world are the poets and their poems. Poetry is a wellspring of traditions, the bleeding connected to yesterdays and the free passport to futures. Poems bind people to language, lead generations to each other, introduce cultures to cultures. Poetry, if given the eye and ear, can bring memories, issue in laughter, rein in beauty, and cure ignorance. Language in the context of the working poem can raise the mindset of entire civilizations, speak to two-year-olds, and render some of us wise. To be touched by living poetry can only make us better people. The determined force of any age is in the poem, old as ideas and as living, as life-giving as active lovers. A part of any answer is in the rhythm of the people. Their heartbeat comes urgently in two universal forms, music and poetry. For the reader, for the quiet seeker, for the many willing to sacrifice one-syllable mumblings and easy conclusions, poetry can be the gigantic river that allows one to recognize in the circle of fire the center of life. The petty shell game. You know, if you walk the streets, you see shell games being played all the time, you know, at least in the black community and periphery to that community. You see it very actively in New York City, down in mid-Manhattan. You know, they got tables set up and moving stuff around. Can you guess where the penny is or something? The petty shell game. But this is a much larger shell game because it's dealing with our lives. With rape memories and clenched fists, with small thoughts and needless time, we indulge in destruction, bathing ourselves in comedy and fraudulent posture. Willa Mae is going with Big Daddy T, and Lula is pregnant and don't know who the father is. Cleavon said the father is we the people. And quite a profound statement among losers and people beaten into the gutter and like desperate rats continue to destroy with Richard G is a faggot. And Pretty Johnny is bald and that rag on his head. And Reverend Jones is going with Sister Mary and Sister Emma and Sister Sarah and Butt. The important issue here always, especially among the young, is where's a party this weekend? And where you get that boss smoke, man? Yet, as the hip whipped often say, only fools work. Not daring to take into consideration that fools built the Western world and raped the rest of it. Yes, only fools work as we non-fools, every early Monday morning, fight each other for position outside the state welfare department. I went to Iowa to teach and to work on a graduate degree. And for a good 2 years, I drove 500 miles a week and didn't miss a week. And I would take detours off of 80 and just go look at Iowa. You know, I stop in these small towns and go in and order a cup of tea, something like that. And then all of a sudden, you know, I see all these people staring at me. You know, I hope he's not moving around here. But anyway, I learned something about this country that I knew, but I did not internalize at the level that I did when I was working at Iowa, and that was the largeness of this nation. This nation is so large, and in many cases, so diverse. But you find that one thing to unite many white people, and I use my words wisely here and carefully, the one thing that unite many white people are the actions of black people. Exactly. White people may argue about everything else, but it's come to black people. They all seem like many of them are able to agree. Whatever the agreement, it doesn't matter. They can agree. White on black crime. Lately and by choice, Milton Washington is self-employed. Working hard, he collects aluminum cans, pop bottles, papers, and cardboard, and sells them to the local recycling center. Milton Washington is an unemployed master welder who has constantly sought work in and out of his trade. He is now seen on beaches and parks and garbage cans, leaving well-lit alleys in the evenings, pushing one cart and pulling the other, head to the side, eyes glued southward, long stepping homeward. Milton's unemployment ran out 14 months ago. First the car went, and he questioned his manhood. Next the medical insurance, savings, and family nights out ceased, and he questioned his God. Finally, his home was snatched, and he disappeared for 2 days and questioned his dreams and all he believed in. Milton works a 15-hour day and recently redefined his life for the sixth time, selecting as his only goal the housing, feeding, and keeping his family together. Yesterday, the PL per pound on aluminum was reduced by 1/4 cent as the stock market hit an all-time high, and the president smiled through a speech on economic recovery, welfare cheats, and the availability of jobs for those who want to work. Milton Washington has suffered the humiliation of being denied food stamps, the laughter and catcalls of children, the misunderstanding in the eyes of his family and friends. Milton believed in the American way, even hung flags on the 4th and special days, and demanded the respect of God and country in his home. A 1/4 cent reduction in pay per pound, Milton Washington will have to add an hour and a half to his 15-hour day. Milton Washington, more American than black, quiet and resourceful, a collector of dreams? Can I close his eyes anymore? Can I excuse a failure in his heart? Can I expect miracles in daylight? It's real close, very, very close to hurting somebody real bad. And of course, the problem with that is that Milton Washingtons of the world end up hurting their own families. We here in Chicago, we were very involved in the liberation of South Africa. And this poem was written for Nelson and Winnie Mandela. Nelson Mandela was still in Robben's Island, and Winnie was, you know, spearheading the struggle and so forth at that time. It's called Killing Memory, and it's from the book Killing Memory, Seeking Ancestors. There's some water in there. Anybody out there? Do they allow y'all to breathe in this room? Killing Memory. The soul in fire, wind songs must not be neutral. Can I be void of birth and dying, wasted life locked in the path of vicious whores masquerading as progress and spheres of influence? For the mothers without milk or willing love, of fathers whose eyes and vision have been separated from feelings of earth and growth, of children whose thoughts dwell on rest and food and human kindness. Tomorrow's future reigns in atrocious mediocrity and suffering deaths. In America's America, the excitement is over a rock singer's glove and burning hair. As serious combat rages over prayer in school, the best diet plan, and women learn how to lift weights to the rhythms of what's love got to do with it? Ask the children. Always the children caught in the absent spaces of adult and juvenility. All breakdancing and singing to everything is everything while noise occupies the mind and garbage feeds the brain. In El Salvador, mothers search for their sons and teach their children the way of the knife. In South Africa, mothers bury hearts without bodies while pursuing the secrets of forgotten foreparents. In Afghanistan, mothers claim bones and teeth from mass graves and curse the silent world. In Lebanon, the sons and daughters receive horror hourly, sacrificing childhood for the promise of land. In Ethiopia, mothers separate wheat from the desert's dust while the bones of their children cut through dried skin. Tomorrow's future may not belong to the people. May not belong to dance or music where getting physical is not an exercise but simply translating the people working, people fighting, people enduring insults and smiles, enduring crippling histories and back pocket politics wrapped in disease blankets bearing AIDS markings and whites, destined for victims that do not question the gifts from strangers, do not question love of enemy. Who owns the earth? Most certainly not the people, not the hands that work the waterways, nor the backs bending in the sun, or the bone fingers soldering transistors, not the legs walking the massive fields, or the knees glued to the pews of storefront or granite churches, or the eyes blinded by computer terminals, not the bloated bellies on toothpick legs, all victims of decisions made at the Washington Monument and Lenin's tomb by aged actors viewing Red Dawn and Return of Rambo Part 9. Tomorrow may not belong to the men and women laboring, hustling, determined to avoid contributing to the wealth of grave diggers from foreign soil and soul. Determined to stop the erosion of indigenous music or building values of traditions. Memory is only precious if you have it. Memory is only functional if it works for you. People of color and voices are locked in multi-basement state buildings seeking memories more efficient than vultures tearing flesh from decaying bodies. The order is that people are to believe and believe. Questioning or contemplating the direction of the weather is unpatriotic. It is not that we distrust poets and politicians. We fear the disintegration of thought. We fear the cheapening of language. We fear the history of victims and the loss of vision. We fear writers whose answer to maggots drinking from the open wound of babies is to cry genocide by demanding 10 cents per word and university chairs. We fear politicians that sell coffins at a discount and consider ideas blasphemy as young people whirl over bleed from the teeth while aligning themselves with whoever brings the food, whoever brings love. Who speaks the language of bright memory? Who speaks the language of necessary memory? The face of poetry must be fire erupting volcanoes, hot silks forging new histories, poetry delivering light greater than barricades of silence, poetry dancing, poetry seeking seers, warriors, healers, and parents beyond the age of babies, poetry delivering melodies that cure dumbness and stupidity. Yes, poetry uttering to the intellect and spirit, screaming to the genes and environments, revitalizing the primacy of the word and world. Poets must speak the language of the rain, decipher the music of the sun, play the rhythm of the earth, demand the cleaning of the atmosphere, carry the will and way of the world, feel the hearts and questions of the people, and can be conditioned and ready to move, to come at midnight or noon, to run against a moneyed hurricane in this, the hour of forgotten sails, forgiven promises, and frightening whispers of rulers in heat. Thank you very much. In 1974, I changed my name. My name was Don L. Lee, and the L stands for Luther. And the new name was given to me, which is Haki Madhubuti. Haki means justice, just or justice, and Madhubuti means precise, accurate, and dependable. This name was given to me. It was not a name I chose myself. I would not have chosen a four-syllable last name, especially in the United States. So let's kind of give you a little bit of short history of my life. It's called Poet, Whatever Happened to Luther. All right. He was strange weather, this Luther. He read books, mainly poetry, and sometimes long books about people in foreign places. For a young man, he was too serious. He never did smile. And the family said, I don't know if he had good teeth. He liked music, too. Even tried to play the trumpet until you heard the young Miles Davis. He said that he had tried writing. The family didn't believe him because there ain't never been no writers in this family. And everybody knows that whatever you end up doing, it got to be in your blood. It's like loving women. It's in the blood, arteries, and brains. This family don't even write letters. They call everybody. That's why the phone's off 6 months out of the year. Then again, his brother Willie T. used to write long, long letters from prison about books he was reading by Malcolm X and Fanon and George Jackson, Richard Wright, and others. And Luther, unlike his brother, didn't smoke or drink, and he'd always be doing odd jobs to get money. Even his closest friends, Clyde and T-Bone, didn't fully understand him. While they'd be partying all weekend, Luther would be traveling. He would take his little money with a bag full of food, mainly fruit, and a change of underwear, and get on the Greyhound bus and go. He said he'd be visiting the city. Yet the real funny thing about Luther was his ideas. He was always talking about Africa and black people. He was into that black stuff, and he was as light-skinned as a piece of golden corn on a cob. He'd be calling himself black and African and upsetting everybody, especially white people. They'd be calling him crazy, but not to his face. Anyway, the family, mainly the educated side, just left him alone. They'd just be polite to him. And every child of God knows that when family members act polite, that means they don't want to be around you. It didn't matter much, because after his mother died, he left the city and went to the army. The last time we heard from him was in 1963. He got put out the army for rioting. He disappeared somewhere between Mississippi and Chicago. A third cousin who found was also polite to appear one day and say that Luther had grown a beard, changed his name, and stopped eating meat. She said he had been to Africa and now lived in Chicago doing what he wanted to do, writing books. She also said he smiles a lot and kind of got good teeth. This is, I'm going to read a few from Hard Love, and then I'm going to end up with a couple of new poems. Hard Love, what in love poem? This is called Tough Love. You might be able to visualize this young brother. You know, just close your eyes as I read. Close your eyes. Tough Love. His soul knows no calling, hears few kind footsteps. He talks street and prison with right hand on his privates. His pants hang low on his hip bone. His language is protective and guttural. He sees with one eye. His walk is drum dance. He runs with a rough road tribe. Wears black gloves on left fist. He never known a personal smile from an adult. His knowledge is popular, urban, and short. He discovered moon, sun, and flowers at 20. The elders in his life is 26, and like him, knows he's in trouble. He's seeking a distant memory, a calling. Last week, a smiling woman called his name. She wasn't carrying weeds or guns or junk food. This is a She Never Grew Up. This is actually about my sister. And we grew up around Pimps and Hoes slamming Cadillac doors on the Lower East Side of Detroit, Michigan, and the West Side of Chicago. And I think our lives were, we existed beyond poverty. I mean, poverty for us was like you're well off. Okay. That's how bad off we are. But my sister was a very beautiful, beautiful woman, just like my mother. And that, in many cases, was her downfall. She never grew up. She lost herself in People magazine beauty. Family and strangers started telling her how beautiful she was before she was born. She absorbed their words at birth and never let go. Her color is mango black wrapped around innocent green eyes. She had a smile that was invented for her teeth. The beauty-confirming words clouded her memory and impeded her walk. She had deficient family to protect her. At 29, she was an old woman. Men had given her everything that she and they thought she needed. They stole her youth, unmarried with 8 children. She did not know the intimate history of her lovers. They all told her repeatedly how beautiful she was. The color of mango black with green eyes. She could not see the lies from the men who always swore that they deeply loved her. Just before they parted her legs, rode her like a horse, took her juice, left their seed, and never said goodbye. In our tradition, we're brothers. His woman is sitting on the back porch. Insects feed off the sweat on her lean body. They've just finished making love. She hurried out of the room to cry, away from his smiles and smell. After the flood of 95, she had promised herself that before she loved him again, she would take to the fields, break bread with nuns, look wolves in the eye, and kneel before the sea of light to armor her heart away from his touch. Her breath, young and spirited, her eyes, lucid and unequivocal, betrayed the armor about her heart. It is he who promised her heart love. It is she who questioned the love in his heart. My wife and I, we have 3 children. 2 came out of Northwestern. One's an engineer, one's a computer science. We have a daughter, came out of Columbia. And our youngest boy is in the rap. So is our daughter to a certain extent. But our youngest boy, he has, when he was at Northwestern, he has his own radio program and everything. And he spins now, but he does have a real job. Believe that. But I told him, I'm one of the original rappers out of the 60s. He said, well, Dad, don't tell me all that stuff. You know what I'm saying? So I said, well, let me try to write a rap for you then, what you do in the day. Let me just try to do that. I'm going to do it without using some of the language that you all are so familiar with, and just see if it's okay. You tell me what it is. So this is called the B Network for the brothers, all right? Brothers bopping, bopping, bebopping, cities locked up and chained insane by cracking other acts of desperation, computerizing, Pentagon selling, producing, bopping, brothers boast of being better, best, and beautiful. If the bopping brothers are beautiful, where are the sisters? Who see brother man with a drugless head unbossed or beaten by the bodacious West. In a time of big wind being blown by boastful brothers, with other brothers be back when it's the better and best without bragging, bosses beating busts, taking names, and digging graves. And beating badness in the bad may be urban, but is it beautiful and serious? Or is a betrayal in an era prepared easy death, hanging on corners trapping young brothers before they know the difference between big death and big life? Now, brothers bopping, bopping, bebopping, cities locked up and chained insane by cracking other acts of desperation, computerizing, Pentagon sellers, producing, bopping, brothers boasting being better, best, beautiful, and definitely not black. And the critical best is that brothers better be the best if they avoid backwardness. Brothers better be the best if they conquer beautiful bigness. Now, comprehend that bad is only bad if it's big, black, and better than boastful braggers, belittling our best and brightest without bosses seeking inches with miles or better. Now, brothers need to bow to being black and bright and above board, the black train of beautiful wisdom that has been in this bind to a new and knowledgeable beginning that is bountiful and bountiful and beautiful. While bebopping to be better than the test, brother man, better yet, write the exam. Okay, I can't. As I wind down, this is a poem from my father who died about 3 or 4 months ago. And This is a man that, I guess if he said one kind word to me in many years that he lived, I never heard it. Jimmy Lee. I was supposed to be named after him, but when I was born, he was off in a, you know, playing poker with his boys, all right? And so my mother asked the midwife to give her a name sheet, and she said, put the name sheet on that wall over there and give me a dart. And then it landed on Don. That's how I got the name Don. Jimmy Lee. And this guy was a player. I mean, he was a hustler. We had a wheel here in Chicago. I used to draw policy on the south side of Chicago. It was a precursor to numbers, all right, to the lottery, all right. And he was a woman man, you know, all the way. I don't know how many times he was shacking up, you know what I'm saying. Jimmy Lee is my dad. My mother's, plural, told me so. My birth certificate states it. My mother, my grandmother confirms that he is. My aunt, his half-sister, swears it to be. My sister, his daughter, believes it to be true. On the street, I'm known as the son of Mr. Lee. I have his height, artistic bent, independent spirit, love of music, size, 11 and a half feet, and an uncanny ability to spot and tell a lie quicker than a fastball taking off speed toward a rookie at the bat for the very first time. Jimmy Lee is my dad. He calls me son whenever he wants something. This is the only evidence that I have of his fatherhood. It has been a profound lesson, and I've never liked baseball. Books has answered. Books saved me. Literature saved me. Two things, literature and music. You know, I don't have time to go into it, but it's just to say books. So this is books' answer. There was only one book in our home. It was briefly read on Sundays and in between the lies and promises of smiling men who slept with their palms out and pants unzipped. It was known by us children as the Sunday book. Rain and books. Sun and books to read. In a home where books were strange as money and foreign policy discussions. And I alone searched for meaning, where rocks and belt and human storms disguise themselves as answers, reference, and revolution. Oh, my. And I alone, I'm sorry, God damn it. Why somebody say, cut off your cell phones? You know? Oh, I'm sorry. At least we get some laughter out there. I'm going to start again. There was only one book in our home. It was briefly read on Sundays and in between the lies and promises of smiling men who slept with their palms out and pants unzipped. It was known by us children as a Sunday book. Rain and books and sun and books to read. In a home where books were strange as money and foreign policy discussions. And I alone searched for meaning where rocks and belts and human storms disguise themselves as answers, reference, and revelation. And I, a young map of what is missing and wrong, in a home empty of books, void of liberating words dancing on as poetry and song, vacuous of language that reveals pictures of one's own fields, spirits, cities, and defining ideas. And I, without the quiet contemplation that meditative prose demands, was left free to drink from the garbage cans of riotous imaginations, was sucked into the poverty of culture destruction and violent answers, until someone, a stranger, a dark-skinned woman with natural hair, in a storefront library, laid a book in front of me, and the language looked like me, walked like me, talked to me, pulled me into its rhythm and stares, slapped me warmly into its consciousness and read, rain and books, and sun and books, were each other's words and winds, were each other's breath and smiles, were each other's memories and mores. We build our stories page by page, chapter by chapter, poem by poem, and play by play to create a life, family, culture, and civilization. Where it would take more than 60 seconds to tell strangers who you really are, to tell enemies and lovers your name. I'm going to end up, the Poetry Center was kind enough to take one poem and put it on a broadside. And I want to end with that. And I would normally, you know, read something about Gwendolyn Brooks, but those of you who've been around me know how dear she is to me. And we just had the State Library named after Miss Brooks. And I did a poem for that, but I'm just going to read the first of two stanzas. Your ancestry is book country, able bones crossing the Atlantic Ocean to discover white pages, protein, and protege in the Midland. And the last stanza, our ancestry is book country and rich earth, galloping souls, skillful deal makers. We are becoming the portrait of your right words. For Gwendolyn Brooks. As you know, 21 young people were killed in E2 down the street. And the Poetry Center was kind enough to put that on a broadside. It's very lovely. I'm going to end with this poem. When 21 is more than a number. We all knew them. They were our children. Chicago's bright moments. Their death stole our hearts and tragically touched the nation. Their memory occupies our dreams, our waking minutes, and the seconds of our deep contemplations. We are now in the rough tomorrows of pain, outrage, and reordering. These young people, these daughters and sons, these developing geniuses at the apex of their calling, would demand a renewed commitment to smiles, safe territory, and the noticing of simple pleasures, grass, sun, the unheard walk of the elderly, the magical laughter of the innocents, dancing them to the melodies of love, embracing the education of young seekers, the taste of fresh grapes, watermelon, peaches, and water. As unthinkable as it seems today, we remain the wind and the lake of their missed lives. We are the answers to their unasked questions. We are the ongoing get-ups and critical yeses of future days. We are the west side, south side of their walked streets. We are the soul, spirit, and source of their beginnings. Do not render their lives irrelevant. They would want us to magnify the alphabet, enlightening the tongues of children.